We have about 100 billion brain cells, neurons, that's functioning nerve cells. The number of possible interconnections between these cells is greater than the number of total atoms in the universe. Now I want to ask you something. Do you not agree with me that the brain was designed to have an eternity of learning experiences? It was never intended by the Lord that we should stop having learning experiences throughout our lifetime. Now, the brain and its neurons can be influenced by a number of things. Now, this great number of things that it can be influenced by include the people we meet, the thoughts we think, the food we eat, the air we breathe, and just on and on and on. And I would like to just discuss a few of these things with you for the next little while. The first thing that I'd like to talk with you about is that with exercise, there is a change that occurs in the mind. Now, you know that there are physical effects that occur with our exercising, such things as good effects on the intestinal tract, good effects on the lungs, good effects on the bones. We will not develop osteoporosis if we get adequate exercise. Good effect on the muscles. We will have good firm muscles that distribute the circulation properly and help us to cleanse the blood and keep the blood in good, healthy condition. Also, every time we breathe in, we exercise the intestinal tract and massage the intestinal tract because the diaphragm goes down and comes back up and goes down and comes back up. And with all of that, there is a massaging of the liver, the spleen, the pancreas, and all of the internal organs, all of the digestive tract. This is an important thing for us in digestion. Also, every time you take a big breath like that, that decongests the head. It also decongests the intestinal tract. And so it promotes digestion when we take a good full inspiration. If you have a tendency to get drowsy in meeting, by all means, take a big deep inspiration and it will often stop the attack of drowsiness in its tracks. You will be delighted if you just sit up straight, take in a deep breath, and notice how the drowsiness has disappeared. It's a very good thing for that.
You hold the breath for a few seconds.
The question is, do you hold the breath? And the answer is no, you do not need to. Just take it in, and that arouses you. It awakens you just to do that. Now, if you breathe in through the nose, that does two things. It cools the blood that goes to the eyelids, and it also cools the blood that goes to the brain. One of the things that makes us drowsy at night, it has been discovered, is an increased temperature of the eyelids and an increased temperature, internal temperature of the brain. Our divine designer has made us so that when we breathe in, we cool the blood that is being pumped up through the internal carotid artery up into the brain. So that's an important thing in cooling the brain. If we start slumping a little bit, which we naturally do when we get tired and as the day wears on, or as we have been on our feet for a long time, we tend to sort of slump just a little bit. That reduces our inspiratory effort, warms the brain, warms the eyelids, and we become drowsy. So when you're sitting in meeting and you're settling down real well, this sort of compresses the lungs and makes it, and we breathe more slowly. And we warm up. We warm up the eyelids. We warm up the interior of the internal temperature of the brain. And this makes us drowsy. Now, with exercise, there is another very important thing that occurs, and that is we produce growth hormone. Exercising and sleep before midnight both produce growth hormone. Now, those two things in the adult are known to produce growth hormone. Now, adults do not produce growth hormone except when we sleep or when we are exercising. Generally speaking, we produce such small quantities that it can hardly even be measured in laboratories. However, if we start to exercise, then we need to produce growth hormone. Growth hormone does a number of things for us. It mobilizes fat, which gives us a source of energy. It also assists us in the production of a normal weight. Therefore, if a person would like to lose weight, one of the things that they can do is to exercise and to go to bed several hours before midnight, because that produces growth hormone. Growth hormone helps us to be cheerful. It helps us to have mental efficiency. In childhood, it also promotes growth. But in the adult, it does not produce growth. We are just as dependent on it for cheerfulness, however, as is the child. And the buoyant spirits of a child are partly due to the fact that he's producing a large quantity of growth hormone, even when he is not exercising or not sleeping, but not so with adults. Now, if we take sugar, get this point, sugar decreases or shuts off the production of growth hormone. Now, if you would like a reference on that, Science, which is the largest scientific publication in the world, Science, volume 150, pages 1051 to 1053. Some of you might like to get the original on that. Thought it was very interesting. Yeah, the comment was made, it's amazing we're not all midgets with all of the sugar that children use. There are other factors involved in the taking in of sugar in childhood which override the thing that we see in adults where there is a reduction in growth hormone. Now, questions? Yes. Yes, exercise before midnight, exercise and sleep before midnight, yes, produce growth hormone.
Which modifies fat and something else?
Modifies fats. It mobilizes fats and also produces cheerfulness. Mm-hmm. All right. Now, yes, question back here. It slows down or stops totally the production of growth hormone in adults.
Is there a certain amount of sugar that is mentioned there in that article?
They gave in the experiment that was done, they gave 25 grams every half an hour. Mm-hmm. 25 grams, that would be 5 teaspoons full. So it wasn't a great deal. They were otherwise fasting. All right, the next thing has to do with the temperature control of the hypothalamus.
It's a drink, I'm not talking alcohol, but juice.
All right, what would the effect of juice that has sugar in it?
Yes.
This particular article in Science didn't go into that, but I'll tell you some other experiments that have used juices, sweetened and unsweetened, and they do find that there is an influence very similar to sugar from juices. So apparently we in the stomach handle juices in much the same way that we do with sugars so far as releasing into the small bowel. We have a higher glycemic index, which means the total quantity of space under the line, the curve made by the blood sugar when it goes up when we're after we take a meal. The glycemic index is higher with fruit juices than it is with a similar quantity of fruit taken as the fruit. One more question, then I'd like to go ahead.
Is that tied to fresh juices or concentrated?
Both, fresh juices and concentrated. Uh-huh. Yes. All right. Now, the hypothalamus has to do with temperature control. Now, we are producing extra temperature all the time by the exercise we do, by the thinking that we do. Thinking produces a good bit of temperature, of heat. It also requires a good bit of energy just to think. We have already spoken about the fact that praying requires more mental energy than any other kind of mental effort. More electrical energy expended in that particular thing. To give you an idea about the marvelous nature of the brain that we have, I would like to just give you some interesting facts concerning temperature extremes that people have survived. A lady by the name of Dorothy Mae Stevens had a very low body temperature. It went down to 64.4 degrees Fahrenheit, which is some 34 degrees below the normal. That was in 1951. Mrs. Stevens survived that because of the enormous adaptation abilities of the body. Now, the adaptation abilities of the body have been specially designed to meet sin, I believe. Because in a perfect world, we would not need that kind of equipment. My feeling is that at the time that Jesus spoke to Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden and told them that he would put enmity between them and the evil one, the lawless one, because of lawlessness, we have come to have the unpleasant climatic conditions that we have in the world today. Because of sin, we have the drought conditions and the flooding conditions and all the other snow and ice and all other unpleasant inconveniences of our weather system. Because of infections and injuries and illnesses of various kinds and metabolic stresses and on, our Heavenly Father had to design a number of emergency measures in our bodies that are used now primarily only for disease conditions. Have you ever wondered what our enormous temperature regulation system would be used for in the earth made new, or our elaborate white blood cell systems? What are they used for when they do not fight allergies or infections or chronic inflammatory states? What are they used for? Nobody knows, but I am quite certain they were either not present in the will not be present in the earth made new, or that our marvelous designer will think of something absolutely new to interest us through the white blood cells. I wonder if we might be able to see them in the eye as they circulate through. Nobody knows, but they are autonomous individuals, and it could well be that we would have some means of communicating with them that we do not now have. Who knows? Our divine designer has something, I am sure, unusual and marvelous to interest us with all of these things. Our pain fibers, our clotting mechanism. There will be no bleeding in the earth made new. There will be nothing that will hurt in all my holy mountains, saith the Lord. So we will not bleed. Why would we need a clotting mechanism then? What will the Lord do with a clotting mechanism in the blood in the earth made new? Well, that we do not know. But the question is, we will get new bodies, and so why would we need some of these mechanisms? That's my point, yes. What is to be done? We will be human beings, which means we have eyes and hair and ears and nose and skin that has melanin in it, but we just don't know all about what the body will be like in the earth made new. Now, I'd like, in this matter of temperature control, I'd like to point out just a couple of things. And one is that our divine designer has made fever so that it is a friend and not an enemy. We should not regard fever as an enemy unless it gets above 107. If it is above 107, then we may be in a problem because of fever. These kinds of hyperthermic states above 107 should be treated by fever-reducing mechanisms, mainly physical things such as the external application of cold, or putting the person in a cold room, or the injection of cool water into the rectum, or giving cold water to drink by mouth. These are ways that we could treat, we could control this kind of thing. But we should not thoughtlessly and needlessly bring a temperature down that's no more than, say, 103 or 104. We should treat the body in such a way as to treat the underlying disease, and in that way, secondarily, bring the body temperature down. Now, the world's record in low temperatures, to illustrate the great adaptability of the body, was a small child, 2 years old, named Vicki Davis, who in 1956 reached a low temperature of 60.8 degrees and survived. Survived, apparently, without any difficulty so far as the brain or the nervous system or anything of this nature is concerned. Now, there are several of you who have your hands in the air indicating you have questions. Would you write your question down? Pick up your pen right now, write your question down, and we'll have a time for that shortly. But let me remind you that the brain is intimately involved in immunity. We have already touched on that. Intimately involved in immunity. We cannot have as good an immune system if we do not have a properly functioning brain, one that has developed symmetrically, one that is properly disciplined. These are essential to the most smoothly functioning immune system. The better our personal discipline, the better our resistance against disease. The less likely we are to come down with some degenerative disease, such as diabetes and atherosclerosis and cancer and a number of other things. We need a disciplined mind. That will help us a great deal. Now, in the production of a fever, we have a number of mechanisms that raise the body temperature, such things as an automatic reduction in the depth of respiration. When we are hot, we will breathe in and out through the mouth many more times than when we are chilly, deeply. When we are chilly, we will rarely take a deep breath, and unless we have a stopped up nose, we won't breathe through the mouth, we'll breathe through the nose, because that conserves heat more. It also conserves moisture more. And when we are chilly, we need to have a ballooned out blood vessel system to push blood into the extremities, and especially against the body's natural mechanism of clamping down with the blood vessels to prevent overchilling of the blood. And so the blood vessels have a very nicely developed mechanism of closing down an artery as it is on its forward movement and opening up a collateral which goes to a side vein so that the blood can go back up to the heart. So it clamps down so it can't go that way, opens up so that it has a ready access to the veins without circulating through the tissues. Now, notice immediately what happens to the person when one has chilliness of the extremities. the blood does not circulate well through the extremities, and consequently we have then an accumulation of waste products and potassium and some other substances in the tissues in the extremities, which cannot be adequately taken care of because of the reduced circulation. And then when we lie down at night and we warm up the extremities, then the blood begins to circulate, and all of this toxic material gets back into the circulation, goes up to the brain, which intoxicates the brain to a small degree and makes it so that we might not be able to think quite so well. It also sensitizes the heart and makes it skip beats. And so we may skip a number of beats. And this is much more noticeable when we go to bed at night. We're lying there in bed, and then it seems all of a sudden as if the heart jumped over or flopped around in the chest, and it bothers us, and we're wondering about that. So the body has a number of ways of trying to maintain its temperature and trying to raise the temperature in a fever. One way that the body uses in trying to raise the temperature in a fever is that of shivering. Shivering is something that you cannot really do well by conscious thought. Just sit right where you are right now and just try to shiver. You can shudder, but you can't shiver very well. Shivering is automatically controlled by the brain. This kind of thing is very important to raising the body temperature when you're getting a fever, or when you're trying to maintain the body temperature when you're too cold. Now, on a day like this afternoon, many of us are likely to be a little on the chilled side. Let me tell you how you can know whether you're chilled. Now, it's summertime here, but this is a chilly day in Alabama. We've just had a nice thunderstorm, and it has cooled the air and cleared off all of the haze, and everything looks nice. So now just feel right back here on the back of your arm. And if you're wearing a sleeveless dress, chances are very good that you will have a cool back of the arm, do you not? Now, feel down on the side of your thigh. You should not have a chilled thigh, most likely. Now feel on the top of your knee, the side of your ankle, and the top of your foot. Any of those places that are not as warm as the hand are chilled. Now, when it warms up, you're going to be dumping into your circulation toxic substances that should have been constantly circulating in the circulation, so that the kidneys and liver and spleen and other parts of the body that have to do with the detoxification of the blood could be operative and active. And so by little things that we do, we make it so that the brain cannot function quite so well. And it is well known to everyone that we are more likely to catch a cold when we have chilled feet or chilled extremities. And so we need to take good care of that. Now here is an article that I would like to tell you about. This was written in Experimental Neurology, Volume 18, page 453, if anyone would like to look up the original article, The Spinal Pathway for Shivering. And it tells about the place where in the spinal cord we have to do with shivering. If we have a spinal cord that is intact, in those areas we can do a good quality of shivering. And we can bring the body temperature up a degree and a half by, not constant, but pretty constant shivering for half an hour. The body temperature, if we don't do anything to bring it down, will go up a degree and a half. Now, if you have a tumor or a stroke or some kind of viral disease of the spinal cord, so that you cannot shiver, you will also not be able to walk, nor will you be able to pass your urine, because they are all carried on the same spinal pathway. We are marvelously made. Could you believe that chewing helps you to have a better circulation of blood to your brain? Now, there are some very important reasons why we should chew our food. And one reason is so that we can get a better circulation of blood to the brain. Now, it's a nice thing to treat your intestinal tract to nicely chewed food. It will relieve a lot of work on the pancreas. The pancreas is an important organ. It is a high-duty organ. You know this big equipment that they work on roads with? What do you call that big equipment that you work on roads? Anybody an engineer in here? Yeah, these big construction machines. All right, just heavy-duty equipment. Let's call it heavy-duty equipment. That's what the pancreas is. Imagine the biggest of one of these road grading machines that you've ever seen. In terms of the body's organs, that's the pancreas, like one of these big road grading machines compared to a lawnmower. It's a heavy-duty piece of equipment. Would you take one of those big road grading pieces of equipment and mow your lawn with it? Well, essentially, you do that kind of thing when you put food into the stomach not properly chewed. You put a great tax on this heavy equipment. You put it to doing a job that it was not intended to do. And so it has to make more enzyme because the lawnmower in the mouth, the salivary ptyalin, is not doing its work. Not only that, we are not notifying the stomach of what is coming to it. You remember that I told you yesterday that parts of the brain stem called the reticular activating system would alert the visual cortex that a vision, a sight was coming, that sight was something, you were about to see something. Well, we have a similar mechanism in the stomach, so that when the food stays in the mouth a good little bit, we notify the stomach of what is coming, and we can see that the stomach has less work to do, less production of acid that it has to go through, less pepsin or pepsinogen that it must produce. And so in this way, chewing can help the stomach. And it is a well-known fact that people who do not chew well have a far greater tendency to get peptic ulcers than do people who chew well. Now also, there is, while we're on the subject of peptic ulcers, if you chew your food well, you will also produce more buffer substance in the stomach. Buffer substance neutralizes free acids in the stomach. So it can be a great help to one to chew well. Now, there are some of us who are concerned with food budgets. If you're on a small food budget, here is something you need to know. Listen to this. The benefit derived from food does not depend so much on the quantity eaten as on its thoroughness of digestion, nor the gratification of taste, so much on the amount of food swallowed as on the length of time it spends in the mouth. Two advantages there. One is on the pocketbook, the other is on the girth. And these are both good advantages, aren't they? Okay, that's Counsels on Diet and Foods, page 107. Very nice little reference there. So we can say that the benefit we derive from our food depends more on the length of time the food spent in the mouth than on the quantity eaten. We could save a lot of money on food bills if we would just understand that good point, couldn't we? Now, we have established the fact that exercise has a beneficial effect on the mind. What kind of exercise is the best? Well, I would like to say that for everybody, if you have it available, The best kind of exercise is that of purposeful labor. I remember once when we first moved to Yuki Pines, we had been promoting exercise in the city where we had lived for many years. We had a jogging club that met every Thursday night down in the Lake Bottom Park, where there was a quarter of a mile official track lighted up at night. And so we would meet down there at night and we would jog around that court, that track. We also had a cycling club that met every Monday. And we cycled through a lovely part of Columbus that had rolling hills and not much traffic. So our cycling club would cycle for no less than an hour. We also had a swimming club that met once a week, and we promoted these activities. This was a part of our religious duty to help people to get plenty of exercise. When we moved to the country, the first thing that we did was to do some purposeful labor right out here across this field, just in the woods. We got to a place where we could remove some brush and get a 1/3 mile track. And so we measured it off accurately and made a track out there. It was beautiful. And one day I was steaming around that track, losing lots of foot pounds of heat into the air, and I thought, I never had really cared much for jogging. Never had been a favorite activity of mine, but I had felt it a duty to do it. And I was thinking, why waste all this energy? I jogged right off that court, that track, went right over to my home and took some tools, a couple of pruning saws and a mattock and an axe, and went out in the place that is now a very lovely cleared off area that shows very nicely the lay of the land that at that time looked like the primeval forest. It was a tangle of muscadine vines and winter huckleberry bushes and sawbriars and a lot of other things that were unpleasant and a tangle and not very attractive, and worked until I got it all cleared off. I spent my exercise period on that little part of the terrain of Yuchi Pines for several months before I got it all cleared off. And that, it could be a blessing to me in physical exercise. And many people have looked at those big pines over there and the nice rolling lay of the land and have commented on how beautiful the Lord's earth is. And I was very happy to be a little part of that. There's nothing there that has a marker that says, Dr. Agatha Thrash cleared off this area. But I know it, and the angels know it, and now you know it. Now, from Desire of Ages, page 72, it says this: by his own example, Jesus taught that it is our duty to be industrious, that our work should be performed with exactness and thoroughness, and that such labor is honorable.
Amen.
Honorable. That's Desire of Ages, page 72. Also on the same page, God appointed work as a blessing, and only the diligent worker finds the true glory and joy of life. What kind of worker was that?
Diligent.
Diligent worker. Only the diligent worker. Who appointed work? He appointed it when? Who was the wealthiest man who has ever lived in the world? Adam. He owned the whole world, didn't he? What was his occupation? Farmer, gardener. That's right. That means that this kind of work is honorable. It is an honorable thing to do this kind, to do physical labor. So many people feel degraded by physical labor. But it is not degrading. It is ennobling. Who planted the garden eastward in Eden? The Lord. That's right. I believe that the Lord and the angels planted the garden. You know, I want to see our great gardener head doing gardening. That will be a sight, won't it? Counsels to teachers, page 122. As early in life as possible, children should be trained to share the burdens of the home. I would like to say to every parent here that if you train your children to love labor, their happiness in life is assured. And I cannot tell you anything in classes on the development of the mind that will improve your children's happiness as much as that. Train your children to love labor. Now, when do they learn to love labor? Is it when they're children? Probably not. Very few children really love labor when they're children. About what time in life do they get so that they start loving labor? Well, sometime in their preteen years, 11, 12, or 13, when they can begin to accomplish things on their own and take responsibility for things, it is then that they begin to love labor. Now, they can love some labor before that. They can love being the granola baker in the family. Now, you must make no mistake about it. Mother is still really the baker. But the child thinks that he is, because he stirs it up. But she may be the one who gets out all the things and helps with the measuring. But he stirs it, and she watches the oven. But the time finally comes when he can watch the oven, when he can accurately measure. But he has been the baker long before that. In his own eyes, he has been responsible for it. And when the granola gets low, mother says, "Son, it's time now. It'll be time for you. Today you'll have to bake some more granola." And so he bakes some more granola. They should have a garden to cultivate, where they may find both amusement and useful employment. Now, what makes gardening amusement? Now, those of you who have children that you have gardened with, you know that there is only one thing that makes gardening amusing to a child, and that's when mother or father, or both of them preferably, take the child to the garden and you work together. If you stay in the kitchen and you say, "Well, I'll wash the dishes," and you go and hoe the tomatoes, that will not be amusement for the child. Generally speaking, true recreation for a child is being in the presence of his parents and doing what they are doing. True recreation is playing at being doctor, or playing at being a fireman, playing at being farmer or teacher or pastor or whatever. That's true recreation for a child, playing at being it. And the more nearly it approximates the true, the higher the recreation value for the child. At first, the child will need to have a small broom that she sweeps, or he sweeps with, as mother uses a bigger broom and sweeps, and they both sweep together. And in the garden, you'll want to buy florist's tools. They are real tools, but they're small for a child. Get the florist tools for a child. They're not as heavy. Then don't expect your child to do heavy labor in the garden. If you will do that, you will find that your child will grow up loving gardening. The training of plants and flowers tends to the improvement of taste and judgment. That's common sense, isn't it? So let's let our children learn about the training of plants and flowers. Exercise and household labor is of the greatest advantage to your girls. Why is it that girls get a lot of good benefit from labor? It's because if you teach a child to labor, teach a little girl to labor when she is really quite small, and you keep her extremities nicely warm, and you do not make tight bands around her abdomen at any time in her life, and you teach her to be temperate in her dietary habits, dysmenorrhea pelvic problems of many kinds and premenstrual syndrome will be much less likely to strike your girls. So these are important principles that you need to learn for the sake of your girls. Now, what about, should you spare your girls in their exercising? I don't really think so. I will tell you how my father used to do it. My father was the most intelligent man that I have ever seen on the subject of getting children to labor and enjoy it. I had only one brother, and there were times when we were set out to do something alone. My father was a dairyman, and we had a lot of land that had to be taken care of, and sometimes my brother and I think the most monotonous and unenjoyable activity that we ever did was hoeing out the fence rows. That was a hot, thankless job. But even that could at times, under my father's very skillful direction, become a very enjoyable thing. And my father would have me work right along beside him. And he would say, "Now, honey, I will lift this." And my love for my father was of such a nature that I would say, "Here, I'll help." And I would run and lift also. And I could see my father struggling with it. And then I know that he would allow me to lift. And I got a strong back out of it. And my father very judiciously watched my development. He assisted me with the proper kind of exercise, of hard physical labor, to meet the strength that I had as a developing girl. My brother, who was 2 years older than I, was given also hard labor, to meet his developing frame. And he judged it by his knowledge of our abilities from his constant observation of our growth. And we were constantly working with him. There was rarely a day that we did not work with my father. Also with my mother. My mother had much more monotonous tasks to do than my father. This is quite fitting because women thrive under monotonous jobs. Women, with their hemispheric lack of specialization, they don't make much complaint about changing the diapers and washing the clothes and sweeping the floor and dusting the house. They can do that day after day, year after year, without much complaint. A man does not do it so much, so readily, without complaint. And eventually finds other things to do if there is anyone who can do that. Because men don't do monotonous things so well as women do. Yes, I'm really serious. Women do monotonous jobs much better. Yeah, that's a characteristic. Now, this is a divinely designed difference between men and women. Women can make factory workers much better than men, where they do the same piecework day by day, year after year, decade after decade, and be happy in it. Men are not so likely to be happy in it for decade after decade after decade. Now, the point of this is, observe your child. A child needs labor with both mother and father, and fathers do not forget that. You are as necessary to the proper growth and development of your child as the mother is. And so your child is pushed to the side, and your child's happiness is pushed to the side. But your child's happiness is a very important thing. If you can accomplish both at the same time, getting the work done and training your child to do the work and to do it happily, you have done a great deal of good for your child. Now, there is some very good research that shows that physical activity, if it is vigorous but not violent, is much better for the nervous system, much better for the mind. Let me tell you about some work that was done comparing individuals who worked at a steady pace as compared and for a reasonable length of time as compared to those who worked violently and for a greater length of time. It was found that those who did a reasonable quantity of work and worked at it a reasonable length of time, that these individuals could do mental work such as multiplication, addition, subtraction, and division. They could do this kind of mental work much better if their exercise was vigorous, though not violent. Now, that's for a short-term type of activity. Then studies have also been done that show that vigorous, though not violent, exercise is best for the mind over the long term as well. Both for vigorous young adults as well as for the geriatric mental patient. Whatever your status in life, vigorous, though not violent, is the thing that we should aim at. And I have taught that for about 23 years, that our exercise should be vigorous, though not violent. Now, while we're studying the subject of exercise, I would like to talk with you just a little bit about metabolic exercising. This is a subject about which there is not much known. Not a great deal of experimenting has been done with metabolic exercising, but let me tell you what metabolic exercising is. It is a change in the status quo in a direction that will give a rest to the metabolic system. One example is that of fasting. If you have been eating right along regularly and you drop a meal or you drop a day or two of eating, it's an exercise for the metabolic systems. It lets them wear in a different direction and different parts of the metabolic machinery than is exercised when we just continue to eat our regular meals all the time. The same thing is true about eating different kinds of foods. It is not well for us to eat the same kind of food day in and day out, not even grains, which are most likely to be taken all the time. But we should eat rice some meals and millet some meals, corn some meals, and rice, wheat some meals, and this can be a very good thing for the body. Some investigators studied the effect of fasting on the autonomic nervous system, which is, what is the autonomic nervous system? We can call it also by another name. What is that? It works automatically. That's right. The automatic nervous system. And it has two great divisions. What are they? Sympathetic and parasympathetic. That's right. Those are the two great divisions of the autonomic nervous system. The autonomic nervous system is one part of the nervous system, and then there is another part of the nervous system. What is that part? The somatic. Okay, so remember there are two major divisions, the somatic and the autonomic. And the autonomic has two divisions, the sympathetic and the parasympathetic. The sympathetic has to do with our fight or flight reactions. The parasympathetic has to do with maintenance, generally speaking. So here were some investigators who studied the effect of fasting on the autonomic nervous system. 2 days of total fasting caused reduction of sympathetic nervous system activity. Now, the sympathetic nervous system can get a little out of kilter. It's somewhat like a central air conditioning and heating unit in your house. as compared to a fireplace and open windows. That kind of heating and cooling system almost never gets out of order. It's so simple. That's the somatic nervous system. But the autonomic nervous system, with its feedbacks and relays and all of the activity that must go on, sometimes just to get our food digested, we may be processing several thousands of impulses per minute just to get food digested, just along one pathway. So we can see that the autonomic nervous system is a very important one. If we have a peptic ulcer, the autonomic nervous system, sympathetic division, may be overworking. We may be producing too much acid with an autonomic nervous system that is overly active. Therefore, a day or two of fasting would do a peptic ulcer patient more good than any amount of medical advice or treatment. Now that's so important, I'd like to say that again. Now I said it in regard to peptic ulcer. I would like to say it now in terms of general disease. A day or two of fasting would do most patients more good than any amount of medical advice or treatment. Now let me continue to read. Both neural and hormonal mechanisms undergo significant transformations over time scales. Skipping one meal, total fasting for about a day and a half, or total fasting over long periods such as 1 to 2 weeks. If a person decides to skip a meal once or twice a week, this is a neural exercise. Or if a person decides to go on a total fast of 2 or 3 days a few times each year, this is also a neural exercise. Total fasting has been shown to be a neural exercise that reduces sympathetic nervous system activity. We can increase sympathetic nervous system activity by violent exercise, such as jogging. You may have gathered by now that I don't believe in violent exercise. I think that we should be in good physical condition so that we could do it if we had to, such as if your house caught on fire, you could put it out. Skip meals with the purpose of exercising the metabolic reserve systems as well as reducing the activity in the autonomic nervous system. Selective fasting is a diet consisting only of fruit or fruit and bread for a few days. And those of you who have very heavy brain labor to do, you will find that it is very effective if you just take a day or two of fasting during the time that that you have this kind of very heavy work, or that you use just fruit and bread or fruit and cereals, plain cereals like plain boiled rice for a few days, 4 or 5 days. If you're under a very heavy emotional drain, take just fruit and bread for several days and you will find that it will temporarily remove the heavy load on your metabolic systems, and especially a lot of protein and a lot of fat is likely to do that. Physical performance can be improved by adhering to a selective fast. Now that would be like a fast of just fruit or just fruit and bread. Well, I find these things very interesting, and if you'd like to know the book that I'm reading from, it is Exercises for the Autonomic Nervous System by S.G. Pickering, P-I-C-K-E-R-I-N-G. The publisher is Charles C. Thomas, and the date of copyright is 1981. So you can get this book and learn how to exercise your autonomic nervous system or your neural systems in general. Now there are a lot of a lot of items that we can study of a physical nature that can give us some good information on how to take care of the mind, how to take care of the brain. And I'd like you to recognize that you must take time for help or be forced to take time for disease. That's an important dictum. The benefits of regular, moderate exercise. And I would like over and over again to stress moderate. Now, a word to those who are addicted to jogging. I would not want anything that I say to remove from you your favorite form of exercise if you really want to jog and you're in physical shape to do so. You may find that it is all right for you. But let me remind you that there are more physical disabilities occurring from jogging than from many other kinds of physical exercise. I would also like to point out that there are a lot of physical disabilities and debilities that come about because of competitive exercise. I am not much for competitive exercise. In fact, it's probably both thumbs down on competitive exercise, and I have a lot that I could say about that that is other than just purely physical. Yes? Question is about aerobics. Aerobics not good? You may do some aerobics and some anaerobics, some isometrics. You may do a number of these different kinds of things. A general rule is do purposeful labor out of doors if you have it available. If you do not have it available, then do a variety of gymnastics rather than just sticking to one kind. For women, while I strongly recommend out of doors activity, if a woman lives in the city, it may not be safe and therefore not good for her health for her to be out of doors, especially taking the same activity day after day after day. We live in a very wicked world nowadays.
Yeah.
Now, some things on exercise, moderate exercise, regular. It improves the efficiency of the heart and lungs. It improves the function of all body systems. Now just think of the systems that we have. The immunity system, the digestive system, the neurologic system, which includes the brain. All of these systems are improved in their function by regular, moderate exercise. Mental and physical tensions are released. That means that when you exercise your organs of motion, you release tension from your organs of emotion. That can be a very good help to the person who has stresses in his life. We can neutralize stress by exercise. Weight control or weight reduction can be greatly helped by regular, moderate exercise. Endurance and muscle tone and strength, flexibility of joints and muscles, and a reduced risk of certain diseases. All of these are benefits of regular, moderate exercise. Now, what does the term abstemiousness mean? Yes, abstaining from that which is harmful and the moderate use of that which is good. True temperance is total abstinence from all things harmful and moderate use of all things good. We cannot speak of exercise without speaking of rest. The body systems need rest. Circulatory, digestive, nervous, respiratory, endocrine, and urinary, all of them need rest. How much rest? Not too much. If we get too much, to give you an example, the urinary tract does not function so well if you sleep too much. We are designed that the kidneys work best when we stand on our feet. Now, there are some very special things that occur during sleep with the kidneys. The kidneys put certain nephrons to sleep. And so here they are. They've just gone to sleep. Now, a nephron is the tiny little, just almost microscopic unit that produces urine in the kidneys. We have, each kidney has some 5,000 to 8,000 of these tiny little things. You can just barely see. They're about the size of a sharp pinpoint in the kidneys normally. When we go to sleep, certain of these go to sleep along with us. Now, they sleep, we wake up, but they keep on sleeping. They may sleep 2 or 3 days. And then the kidneys, by some alarm clock that nobody understands, it says you wake up and you 18 go to sleep. So they go to sleep, and here's one that wakes up over here. Then one of these 18 has to wake up in the morning. The other 17 sleep. We have no idea why. How that is controlled, nobody knows. But it's the most marvelous mechanism. We require a certain amount of sleep in order to regulate that for the kidneys. But if we sleep too much, then the kidneys don't function so well. And we begin to retain certain waste products, and the kidneys don't circulate so well. And we produce certain hormones that are not so good for us. And so it's just not very good for the kidneys nor any other system of the body for us to sleep too much. Now, here is something that I would like to direct your attention to. It's the effect of exercise on ideas and emotions and on the autonomic nervous system. Good, thank you. Let me see if I can... Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Pardon me for not seeing that earlier. There we go. Can you all see that? Now, I need you to... you'll see the title of it up there, The Effect of Exercise on Ideas, Emotion, and the Autonomic Nervous System. Now, I'd like to move it up so that you can see this muscle right down here. That's what I need you to look at. This muscle right here. See that? Skeletal muscle. Now, that's the functioning unit that the nerves are attached to. And here is a motor end plate, this little black bar right here on the muscle. This is labeled, as you see here, a proprioceptor. When we did the little exercise yesterday of standing on one foot, the proprioceptors were what helped you to stay on your feet, on your foot. Even with your eyes closed, the proprioceptors will tell you exactly where every part of your body is so that you do not have to guess. Even behind your back, you know just where all of your muscles and body parts are. Through the properly functioning proprioceptors. Now notice that a message goes up to the brain, connects right up in here in the hypothalamus, then that connects on up here into the limbic system, which you are now very much acquainted with, and then goes on up to the cortex up here in the area where we have motor control. Then if we want to make a muscle move, we do it the other way. A thought begins up in here and it comes down here and makes the muscle move. So we find out where we are with our muscles through the proprioceptor system, and we make the muscle move through the other system, the motor system. All right, so here we are. Sitting here thinking, not using any of this system very much. Now, in order to maintain an erect posture, we have to use the proprioceptor system. But mainly, we're not using this system right now. We're using this system that you see here in the gray matter, with all of these connections, one after the other. And you can see that they have a bit of a circuitry. See, this neuron is attached to this one, and then it goes down here like this and doubles back over here like this, or comes down here and goes down into this gray matter. There is white matter all between these, in between all of these areas of gray matter, which are the stippled ones on my diagram. Now, thoughts are received in one part of the brain, then go to another part of the brain, and another part of the brain, and another part of the brain. And so they tend to have a circular motion inside of the brain, like this. But when we exercise, we have a perpendicular rather than a horizontal circuit that we do. If you are worried about something and you cannot shake it from your mind, you think about it again and again, and the mind dwells on it. What happens to the mind when the brain is holding something in it all the time and you're dwelling on it? You get into a bondage to it. It gets to be a wearing thing for the brain. It actually damages, it injures the brain. It may injure it so that it takes a year or two or five or 80 to repair. And so we do not want to allow the brain to dwell on something that is injuring it, like guilt or fear or anxiety, because of its wearing ability. How can we stop it? You might say, oh, I would like to, but it worries me so. I've been thinking about it all day. I know that when I go to bed tonight, I'm not going to be able to sleep a wink because I'm going to be rehearsing it and going over it and over it and over it. I'm going to be thinking what I should have said to her or what she said to me and how it hurt. And you know how the mind will do that kind of thing to you? You must not allow that. How can you avoid it? Do physical exercise. And it interrupts the circuits here, because you have electrical traffic going in a perpendicular fashion in the brain and in the nervous system that simply interrupts the horizontal circuits of thought. And it makes it so that you can much more easily turn the mind to something else. Now, if you feel that you would like to chop off somebody's head, take an axe and go out and chop wood. Or take a hoe and go out and chop the weeds up out of your garden. If you are burdened by financial responsibilities, go out and see how wealthy your Heavenly Father is. He has the air, priceless. The sunshine, essential. He has the rocks that are precious. The birds that you cannot buy for any price. He owns all of these. And he has said that he will help you with all. I am sufficient for all your need. That is his word to us. And so I recommend that you not allow your brain to become overburdened by these things. Question is that why you get confused when you get... That's right. That is one reason why you become confused with... That's right. Now, I would like to study some of the faculties and laws of the mind. So let's spend a little time on that. Faculties and laws of the mind. Now, a faculty of the mind is the same as an organ of the mind or a talent of the mind. And we see here a number of these faculties of the mind: compassion, control of the body, imagination, knowledge, affections, inspiration, energy, ambition, watch care. That's also, we could say, caretaking. Identity, personal identity. We need to know who we are. It's a faculty of the mind to know who we are. We evaluate ourselves. When do we learn who we are? Did I learn who I was when I became Mrs. Calvin Thrash? Did I learn who I was then? What age did I learn who I am? When I became a mother? When I became a physician? When did I learn who I am? I learned who I am when I was about, I began learning when I was about 1 minute old. The way I was treated when I was 1 minute old, I began to understand who I am. The way that I saw others interact in my home, I began to understand who I am. When I saw how my father respected me as a person, but was supervisory over my growth and development. When I saw the tenderness and the love that my mother had for me, and the caretaking that she took with my education, in that way I learned my identity. The intellect. When is the intellect sharpened? Is it when we go to college or when we enter graduate school? The intellect begins, and we start with this faculty of the mind and disciplining it when we are very young, just a day or so old. We start with intellectual achievement. Reason, tact, will, judgment, patience, perception, wisdom, endurance, consciousness, language, memory. These are all faculties of the mind. They are faculties that can help us in the daily activities that we have. Now, everything that I have here is learned. Everything that I have here is trainable, including the will. But we are born with a freedom of the will. We are born, that's the only thing that is uniquely myself. Everything else has to do with other people, has to do with my teachers, my parents, my other siblings in the home. Anything of this nature, all the faculties of the mind that we see here are faculties that represent to some degree what we are told. Take reason. We learn to reason by what we are told about things. We are told the reason why light goes out when we turn a switch. We learn a reason. We are told reasons why a book is damaged when it gets wet. And that's another way that we learn reason. But somebody has to tell us. In order for us to learn anything, we must have faith. We cannot learn anything without faith. Not anything. We cannot learn to add, know what the ABCs are, without faith. Because you must take something that you have had no experience with from someone else and put that into your mind as if it were your own experience, even though you have not had experience. Take when you're learning to read. Your teacher says, this is A. You believe her because she is an authoritative figure for you and you have faith in her. So she says, it's A. You've had no experience with A. You don't know how to spell nor to read. You've had no experience with A. But you have faith in her. You learn that that is A because she says that it is. Well, what if she shows you a T? You will then have learned that A is T. And you may have then an error in your mind. Whether you learn error or whether you learn truth, faith is required to learn anything. Will we are born with freedom of the will, and it is this that helps us to be an individual, that makes us an individual. We may submerge the will and the identity and the individuality in another person so that we have no will of our own, but this is not God's plan for us. Now, there are faculties of the soul as well. Can you see those? And I'll just read a few of these, not all. Desire to know God, capacity to know God, hope, right habits, firm, decisive principles, courage, meekness, fortitude, faith, unwavering trust, grace, judgment, self-control, affections, watch care. These are all faculties of the soul. Now, in order that we might properly exercise our faculties of mind and soul, we need to recognize our rights. And I'd like to talk with you about the rights of the individual. What are the rights of the individual? Well, we have maybe some 2, 3, or 4 rights. And let me just mention a few. The control of your own mind is your right. God gives you that right. He does not give that to your physician, although many people would abdicate it to the physician. Will abdicate, do, every day. They abdicate the right to use their own mind. They abdicate that to their physician every day. They have no idea what this medication is that he is giving to them, or whether or not they really need that surgical procedure that he is recommending. They do not control their own minds nor bodies. This is a God-given right. You may smoke if you wish. An angel does not knock the cigarette out of your hand. You have the proper right to control your own mind. You have the right to be an individual from the cradle to the grave. Many parents teach their children to submerge their own will in theirs. And many parents submerge their wills in their child's. And probably in the day that we live in, more parents are controlled by their children than children controlled by their parents. That's an amazing thing to watch. Now, what about, I mentioned to the grave, it's your right to control yourself from the cradle to the grave. When you're about to die, you still have the right to control yourself. That is, of course, within the bounds of what is moral and what is legal. Then another thing, you have the right to worship according to the dictates of your own conscience. That's a God-given right, and nobody should deny you of that. You have the right to the control of your own talents. If you would like to use your talents in one way or another, you have that right. God has given that to you. You have the right to receive and to impart the fruits of your own labors. That means wages, or if you make a quilt and you want to give it away, it's your right to do that. You have the right to use your time as you see fit. Now, those are rights.
The right to use your
time as you see fit. The right to use your time as you see fit. Now, let me just discuss a little bit the rights of the spouse. I've mentioned a little bit about the rights of a child. The rights of a spouse. Number one, to share all property. Number two, to share one another's time. How much? All. And when you get married, you have willingly told that one that you have given yourself to, we are inseparable. My time is yours. My property is yours. My influence is yours. My name is yours. We have the rights of a spouse are to share the name and the family characteristics of another individual. Now, you will immediately recognize that some of these are not only rights, they're obligations. You must share in your spouse's family and in your spouse's character. Notice that when you share someone's name, you do share their character. Name is character. Now, let's just take the Christian's attitude toward my rights. The Christian's attitude. Number one, I will not exercise my rights where doing so infringes on the rights of others. That is, I will not exercise my rights where doing so infringes on the rights of others. Secondly, if my rights are denied, I will not insist on exercising them. Third, the Christian will recognize that before God, there are no rights deserved after one has sinned except death. The Christian will recognize that before God, there are no rights deserved after one has sinned except death. And therefore will maintain a constant attitude of grateful praise.
Amen.
Let me read that whole thing again. The Christian will recognize that before God there are no rights deserved after one has sinned except death, and will maintain a constant attitude of grateful praise. Now I'd like to read from Testimonies for the Church, Volume 5, page 558. God is observing everything that transpires in the office. Now, while this has to do with a specific condition, you will see that the principle permeates all of life. This is 5T558. Okay? God is observing everything that transpires in the office. Quote, thou, God, seest me, should be always in mind. Everyone who bears responsibilities in the office should be courteous and kind to all. An ever-abiding sense of the presence of Christ would prevent the encroachment upon others' rights, which is so common in the world's practice, but which is an offense to God. The love of Jesus must be incorporated into the lives of the workers in the several departments of the office in order that justice may be done not only to the work, but to one another. Did you get that? Not only to the work, but to one another. So we see that we do have rights, and that these rights are common to all people. Now, there are many things about the rights of the human that need to be carefully studied in order that we might give our children and all others their proper rights.
You have been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright American Cassette Ministries, all rights reserved. To order CDs or audio cassettes of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 1-800-233-4450. International calls, please dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americancassette.org. There you will discover the largest selection of genuine Adventist preaching available. American Cassette Ministries is not a one-man band. It's an orchestra of outstanding speakers We're all on the same theological page. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Cassette Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? Our email address is info@americancassette.org. We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and financial support are important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.